Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this lecture in the Senate Department's occasional lecture series. This year we're marking the centenary of the selection of the site of the Capitol, leading up to the centenary of its actual founding in a few years' time. And we're very fortunate to have here today the world's greatest expert on the history of Canberra, and an expert on many other aspects of history as well. And not only that, but a star of television. You've seen him on television, now's your chance to see him live. And as you can see, he attracts television cameras wherever he goes. Please welcome Dr. David Headon to the...
Thanks, Harry, for those kind words. The topic for today's talk is Wanted, Treasure House of a Nation's Heart, The Search for an Australian Capital City, 1891 to 1908. When you look at any one of the iconic photographs of the Federation founders at the convention meetings of the 1890s or in the first years of the federal parliaments in Melbourne, it is hard to avoid resorting to stereotypes. They do project as a group of natty middle-class lawyers, judges and businessmen and the odd aspirational labour man, which they basically were. All men, sober, sedate, apparently satisfied, and mostly hirsute. An abundance of facial hair was the fashion of the era. A snapshot judgment today might well describe them as a bunch of boring old farts. Nothing, of course, could be further from the truth. The reality is that the overwhelming majority of these men emerge as extraordinary characters, gifted, engaged, single-minded when needed, occasionally partisan, and very, very human. Most of them loved a joke. They lived in large times and spoke, and for some like jovial George Read, ate accordingly. They applied themselves with rigour and patience to the dominant public issues of the day, demonstrating a capacity, determination, and eloquent self-assurance often missing in our national conversations of the 21st century. This resolute attitude of the Federation founders is never more apparent than in the parliamentary debates and community controversy surrounding the narrative accurately and distinctively labelled at the time as the Battle of the Sites. One of the most interesting individuals destined to play an active role in the national capital narrative is William Astley, journalist, notable bulletin short story writer on convictism, and an incorrigible opium addict. For well over a decade, Astley happily assumed, I use the term advisedly, the role of promoter of the town of Bathurst's claims to being the national capital. In all likelihood, he wrote most of the note prefatory that appeared in a 1901 Bathurst tourist booklet in which the future, much-coveted capital site is described as the treasure house of a nation's heart. The competition nationwide to become that treasure house was keen from the start. In the nearly 20-year period throughout which the Battle of the Sites raged, from the early 1890s to 90, numerous towns came and went, crashed and burned. Sometimes re-emerged, phoenix-like, from the flames, only to burn again, until in the last months of 1908, amidst controversy and name-calling, brinksmanship and hectic behind-closed-doors number-crunching, the site that was marketed as Yas Canberra emerged victorious. But it was a desperately close-run thing. Indeed, after the House of Representatives voted 39-33 for Yas Canberra over Bombala on the 8th of October 1908, 100 years ago last week, the Senate settled down to its own session on the 28th of October, an exhausting debate which continued until the 6th of November. There could be no seat of government act without the Senate's endorsement, and after many hours of discussion, argument and abuse, the 36 senators there to decide finally between Yas Canberra and Tumut were deadlocked. 18 apiece. The New South Wales senators went en masse for Yas Canberra, the Victorians for Tumut. And it was only when the Victorian, James Hears McColl, switched his vote, to the disgust of his fellow Victorians, and later Melbourne's Age newspaper, which accused him of ratting out his state, that the bill progressed to obtain the necessary royal assent on the 14th of December 1908. The ensuing Seat of Government Act of 1908 brought to an uneasy close a process which involved no less than 7 Commonwealth governments, 5 New South Wales governments, 2 royal commissions, 9 Commonwealth ministers for home affairs, 4 lapse bills, and 3 acts of the Commonwealth Parliament. This battle of the sites might be more accurately termed a war of attrition. In today's paper, taking my lead from a former clerk of the House of Representatives, thank you kindly, who said that the full story was, in his words, too long and too devious to recount in one evening, I will discuss this search for our nation's treasure house city in one lunchtime, in terms of 2 distinct periods. The decade from 1891 to Federation, and the 7 years from 1902 to 1908. While I will provide, I hope, the basic details of the story, I don't intend to trawl over the established linear chronological narrative as such, done capably by Roger Pegram in his soon-to-be-republished book, The Bush Capital, How Australia Chose Canberra as Its Federal City, which came out first in 1983. I want to focus on particular aspects of the story, some of them up until now hidden aspects, that encourage us to reassess the received narrative and put some new faces into the frame. For the more you get to know the men behind the suburban and street names of Canberra, the more compelling they become, and the more the absorbing Canberra story comes to life. First, some necessary background detail. The search for an Australian capital city effectively began with 2 important political events at the beginning of the 1890s. The first of them was the Australasian Federation Conference in Melbourne in February 1890, where Sir Henry Parkes, that long, white-bearded, impressively virile, grand old charlatan of a man, rallied infant national sentiment a full 10 years before Federation with his creative reference to, and you'll know the phrase, the crimson thread of kinship that runs through us all. At the same conference, the emergent leader of the Federation movement in Victoria, Alfred Deakin, spoke loftily of the commonality shared by all 6 Australian colonies. A people, as Deakin put it, one in blood, race, religion and aspirations. At the second and far more significant meeting, the National Australasian Convention held in Sydney in March-April 1891, and destined to adopt a draft constitution bill to constitute the Commonwealth of Australia, the rhetoric from the leading delegates was similar to Melbourne. Parkes' banquet toast was to one people, one destiny. And his subsequent address anticipated the inhabitants of the southern continent becoming an Australian people, and their country the brightest jewel in the crown of the empire. Yet despite this consciously elevated tone, this agenda manipulation, the problem with the Melbourne and Sydney meetings, the elephant in the room that could only be kept docile for so long, was that the utterances of Parkes and Barton and Deakin and their ardent fellow Federationists present could only temporarily disguise the tension of colonial rivalry and colonial jealousy. Deakin might well trumpet that all present at the convention were one in blood and aspiration, but everyone there knew that the New South Wales Victorian already had a long and often bristling history. Since the discovery of gold in the early 1850s and consequent rapid Victorian advancement, they had been constant rivals. At the Melbourne conference, the uneasy truce collapsed when one of the New South Wales delegates, the treasurer in the New South Wales government, William McMillan, gave a foretaste of what lay ahead when he verbally brandished the superior role and claims of his colony, triumphantly referring to New South Wales as the mother colony. Let delegates be in no doubt, said McMillan, if Federation did occur, it would be New South Wales making the greatest sacrifices. Understandably, such a provocative line failed to impress the non-New South Wales delegates, especially the Victorians. And then in Sydney in 1891, exactly the same thing happened. This time George Dibbs, a New South Wales delegate and future New South Wales Premier, dropped what became known as Dibbs' bombshells when he proposed, as the capital city of a future federation, Sydney. Sydney. His own hometown, his patch. Favoured by nature, gushed George Gibbs, favoured by the great creator himself. Dibbs put the motion and the cat among the pigeons. Sydney must be the new nation's capital. While the motion predictably failed dismally amidst widespread mirth and cynicism amongst the other non-New South Wales delegates, it was clear that if federation did occur, then the issue of where the national capital would be sited was certain to be controversial. South Australia's very dignified Richard Chaffee Baker referred to it as the burning question, and he advocated postponement. The entrenched federationists among the delegates to the convention could not agree quickly enough. While federation still only a possibility, the national capital issue was simply too hot to handle. But while the politicians judiciously paused, the citizens of the colonial continent enthused. Postponement was the catalyst for continental aspiration. Cities, towns and regions across the country began to fancy their chances of becoming this treasure house of a nation. What started almost immediately following the 1891 convention was a lively and at times undignified scramble by a host of opportunist individuals and their cities, towns and regions to assert their preeminent claims. Propaganda booklets began popping up like mushrooms. Propagandising journalists leapt into print to tout the next big thing, the next speculative national capital site. The cocky residents of the two urban powerhouses, Sydney and Melbourne, thought they were certainties, naturally. But the queue was forming quickly, with a myriad list of possibilities, the vast bulk of them drawn from the colonies, the big three, of South Australia, Victoria and New South Wales. Sydney surveyor and engineer F. Oliver Jones in 1894 called his imagined imperial capital Pacifica, a model city beautiful in the virgin bush of Coringai Chase on the banks of the Hawkesbury. Character building and nation building sport would be played, as Jones put it, on a pan-Britannic sports ground in a revival of the ancient Olympic Games. And remember, this was 2 years before the Olympic Games were revived as the modern Games in Athens in 1896. Jones promoted a model empire-building community shaped on new yet British lines. Others dream more adventurously, if less practically. In August 1894, the same year that Jones proposed his Pacifica, the Bulletin ran an elaborate article entitled Democratic Federation by the radical Queensland journalist and politician J.G. Drake, in which he imagined a grand capital of some 50,000 square miles situated at Cameron Corner. Where, you ask? That's where the arid inland borders of New South Wales, South Australia and Victoria meet. As Professor Duncan Waterson writes, Drake's national capital was to be, take out Victoria, I didn't mean that, was to be free from coastal heat and debilitating alcohol, alien and Aboriginal free, socially pure and productive of superior Australian Britons in terms of physique, intellect and institutions. Drake's ideal citizens in a vision consistent with the race-driven community values of the era would be the superior prototypes of the new Australian clean white warrior race. Such a race would apparently populate and purify the nearby towns of Cunnamulla, Charleville, Thargaminda, and Bourke. Drake's proposal was so seriously discussed that in 1896 it was published as a standalone booklet in Brisbane under the title Federation, Imperial or Democratic. Clearly, the inland utopia built with eugenic community bricks got others thinking, for in the same year that Drake's dream was reprinted and promulgated, another bulletin writer conjured something similar, this time located in the isolated McDonnell Ranges of South Australia, a utopian home intended to open up the interior and keep out the blacks and black labour syndicates. Most proposals, however, were not as extreme as those of Jones and his clones. Murray River towns such as Echuca, Corowa and Albury, for example, portrayed themselves as an ideal compromise for the dominant three colonies. Ballarat, the heavily supported, marvellous city of Ballarat, according to one commentator, packaged itself as a city with undeniable national prominence. A city built on gold, the Eureka Stockade and democracy, gardens, Lake Wendouree, and civil amenity. According to the Ballarat Courier of February 1898, gold, loose and in nugget form, shouted the name Ballarat to all corners of the globe. When the Honourable Edmund Barton, soon to be Australia's first Prime Minister, what country doesn't know the name of its first Prime Minister, when Barton visited Ballarat in February 1898, he consciously avoided any discussion of Ballarat's capital claims, refusing, as he said, to encroach on its subject. But he could still be fulsome in his praise of the city's great industries and fertile fields, its prosperous infrastructure. Industry was also the keynote of the bids of South Australia's Port Augusta and Mount Gambier, the former based on intercolonial and international ocean trade, and the latter promoted because of its superior climate and scenery, central location and proximity to the nearby harbour port of Portland just over the Victorian border. Within months of the Australasian Federation Conference in Melbourne at the beginning of 1890, South Australian Legislative Councillor Dr. Alan Campbell, addressing the citizens of Port Augusta with a talk entitled Federation and South Australia, could not contain his enthusiasm. He concluded with the flourish of a rich rhetorical question. Where then can a situation be selected for the future seat of the federal government possessing such advantages as Port Augusta offers? I do not see one on the whole map. While few outside Port Augusta would have agreed with Councillor Campbell, sentiment like his infected the entire nation throughout the 1890s. Patently, no town, no spot was ruled out amidst the ambition, wild hope, and barely suppressed euphoria of an otherwise difficult decade. But then, as has been well covered elsewhere, a so-called secret deal at the hastily convened Colonial Premiers' Conference in January-February of 1899 abruptly changed the rules of the game. After the first Federation referenda failed in 1898 because a truculent New South Wales insisted that there must be an arbitrary figure of 80,000 yes votes rather than a simple majority, New South Wales Premier George Reid, ever the experienced showman and cunning politician, perceived advantage for his home colony. He played his trump card at the Premier's Conference. If New South Wales, the self-ascribed mother of the colonies, if New South Wales did not get the nod to host the capital, then, Reid told his fellow premiers, he could not see the colony ever wanting to be in a continental federation. Now, this was crude gunboat politics, but it obtained the desired result, a rewriting of the relevant part of the Constitution draft, section 125, to read, "The seat of government of the Commonwealth shall be determined by the Parliament and shall be in New South Wales and be distant not less than 100 miles from Sydney." Yes, the capital would be in New South Wales, but the other states had made certain that Sydney would be excluded. And more, until there was such a capital, the Victorians secured the compromise deal that Melbourne would be the temporary site. Many Melburnians were soon of the opinion that their sizeable foot in the section 125 door would eventually get them the capital permanently. The draft constitution with these very specific national capital clauses was signed into British law by the Parliament and Queen Victoria in July 1900. The leading Australian politicians of the day, among them Barton, Deakin and Charles Kingston, revelled in their triumph. It has been said that after the vote, they retired with appropriate dignity and decorum to a Westminster committee room, whereupon they joined hands and danced a jig of unbounded celebration. Australia had its federation, its constitution, and its section 125. What began then was a far more formidable set of engagements in the Battle of the Sites, when for six more years, 1902 to 1908, a newly energised bunch of New South Wales towns began to assert their fresh claims to being Australia's new capital city. It was a battle fought as tigerishly and as tactically as any wartime conflict, but right from the start, in 1901 to 2, the written and unwritten rules of the battle were well understood by the combatants. First off, of course, the site had to be New South Wales, 100 miles from Sydney, at least. Second, the site would be inland, for a coastal city risked both the outbreak of disease and bombardment from foreign ships. Third, the site must have a plentiful water supply. Fourth, the site must be a beautiful one, a place where nature could elevate and inspire, a place combining the attributes of the city beautiful and the garden city. And finally, and perhaps most significantly at the time, the site must be in a cold region. In the second half of today's paper, I want to focus our attention on arguably the three most intriguing combatants involved in the Battle of the Sites, three key case studies, if you like. First, the town of Bathurst. Its bold bid and poised promotional strategy brought unstuck by the harsh reality of Section 125. Poor old Bathurst was perceived by those who counted to be just inside the 100-mile limit. It was just too close to Sydney. Second, the remote Snowy River town of Dalgety. The focus of such close attention in 1904 and again briefly, formidably, in 1908 that it went within a whisker of actually becoming Australia's national capital. And there is, of course, a Commonwealth seat of government act the 15th of August 1904 to prove it. And finally, the option known as Yass Canberra, which would receive the royal assent at the end of 1908. So case study number one, Bathurst. The lament of the failed Bathurst bid. Bathurst was such a busy colonial town, such a constant production line manufacturer of sporting and cultural achievers, that by the 1880s it had become a thriving metropolis. The town attracted many quality citizens from elsewhere, not least the man destined to make a literary name for himself under the pseudonym of Price Warham for his classic stories on convictism published in the Bulletin and read throughout the country. But that would be in the 1890s. In the 1880s, Astley paid a visit to Go Ahead Bathurst and stayed, soon obtaining a following with his searching political columns in the Bathurst Daily Times and the Bathurst Free Press and Mining Journal, a number of them exploring his passionate commitment to the Federation cause. Astley sought to educate and to enlighten his readers. In White Australia's centenary month, January of 1888, he took the symbolic opportunity to question the manifest failings of British imperialism, thus anticipating his anti-transportation short stories to come. And he proposed the idea of what he called a federal compact for the Australian colonies. 3 years later, energised by the 1891 convention in Sydney, Astley wrote no less than 16 editorials for the Bathurst Free Press over a one-month period in May-June 1891 in which he enlisted liberation and its principles. It was a more or less natural progression when, in September 1896, in an intentionally provocative letter to the editors of Bathurst newspapers, that Astley began to push the claims of his treasured Bathurst as the best available choice for the coming national capital. In the same letter, he proposed a people's convention to be held in Bathurst as soon as possible in order to reignite popular interest in the Federation issue and no doubt to strategically position his adopted town. Despite a history of debilitating lapses as a result of his opium addiction, Astley, over a number of years, had gained respect and a well-earned reputation. Accordingly, his People's Convention idea was immediately acted upon, with Astley appointed as its organising secretary. Incredibly, the large event took place just months later, in November, and it went script perfectly, except for the fact that Astley got arrested and jailed during the gathering for a £15 debt. That's a long story. John Norton comes into the story. The historic Bathurst People's Convention of November 1896 was widely credited at the time with, as it was put, popularising Federation, and a number of historians since have confirmed this conclusion. It attracted over 150 delegates, went for a week, and proceeded smoothly thanks to a thoughtful agenda put together by the absent, imprisoned Astley. Throughout the convention, Astley's teasing letter of a couple of months earlier would have been vigorously discussed. His brash promotion of Bathurst drew attention to a number of the town's special advantages, its claims to being the capital city. Centrality, accessibility, a salubrious inland location in the event of foreign invasion, independence from, and a healthy attitude to, both Sydney and Melbourne, and imposing public buildings. Bathurst's King's Parade Makati Park complex, structured around a government building group designed by renowned colonial architect James Barnett, was a particular source of local pride. Yet, despite Astley's and Bathurst's timely initiative, when the secret Premier's deal established the wording of Section 125 of the Constitution, Bathurst found itself in no better position than any other New South Wales town. In fact, by cruel chance, it was worse off on technical grounds. For despite the vigorous campaigning by an energetic citizenry, despite being a thriving town, well located inland and chilly in winter, with more impressive public buildings and parks, despite having arguably the finest promotional material circulating among the key decision-making politicians, no less than three volumes written by Astley between 1901 and 1904, the first of them with the attention-grabbing title Bathurst, the Ideal Federal Capital, that was 1901. Despite all of these obvious credits, by 1902, when the real work of locating a capital started, poor old Bathurst had effectively run its race and disappeared from view. Why? That immovable and immutable Section 125's 100-mile limit, the bloody limit. Bathurst, it was concluded, lay just inside. In the Ideal Capital volume, in a preliminary note, the book's printer and publisher, Glyndwr Whalen, desperately sought to diffuse this problem. But you can almost sense his anxiety when he writes, "The men whom the nation calls to the task will surely not lack either the judgment or the courage to say, if need be, to the people of Australia, enlarge the radial limit by a fraction, and we will give you a perfect site for the territory and capital." Alas, the plea was ignored. The chicken bone in Bathurst's throat, that wretched clause, choked its initially confident, if ultimately ill-fated, bid to be the treasure house of a nation's heart. Case study two, Dalgetty. The third and concluding meeting of the three Australasian Federal Convention meetings of 1897-8, held in Melbourne in the summer months of early 1898, adopted the amended draft constitution. The attending delegates sweltered in the intense January Melbourne heat, so it was no surprise when the popular John Forrest, gifted surveyor, noted explorer, and West Australian premier since 1890, crystallised the popular sentiment of the gathering when he gave voice to what has since been referred to by myself and others as the cold climate myth. That widely held belief of the time that the Anglo-Saxon and Anglo-Celtic peoples functioned at their best, their British Empire best, in a cold climate. That's right. White intelligence and the leadership instinct revelled in the frost and the wind and the snow. Forrest, despite the obvious implication for his own colony, applied the belief directly to the national capital debate when he stated that the new capital, in his words, ought to be a cool place, indeed the coolest place in Australia. In the years that followed, this stance largely drove the debate. The cold climate myth meant that otherwise attractive New South Wales locations, such as Port Macquarie or beautiful Byron Bay, were not considered. The Federation founders, in search of their ideal federal capital, looked for inspiration northwest to Armidale, west beyond unlucky Bathurst, and especially straight south of Sydney. Well, if you like, south, west, south, south, southwest, I guess you'd say. Snow-capped mountains, not beaches, were the geographic fashion of the era in an Australia still very, very British. American import, the legendary King O'Malley, another active participant in the national capital narrative, would develop a particularly soft spot for Bombala in the remote south. When he visited the town, he asked only just, tongue-in-cheek, whether it was true that, to start a cemetery in Bombala, the locals had to import dead men from Sydney. In the House of Representatives debates of October 1903, O'Malley was more expansive. If ever there was a spot set apart by the Creator to be the capital of this great Australia, the pivot around which white civilization should revolve, it is Bombala. Waxing biblically lyrical, he continued, I could almost see the Garden of Eden at Bombala. I could see Adam and Eve leaving after they had eaten of the tree of life, for the tree of life is growing there today. Bombala was for O'Malley the tangible proof that, and these again are his words, the history of the world shows that cold climates have produced the greatest geniuses. While such extremes were characteristic O'Malley, part of the salesman Spruker's craft, they do give us some insight into the values and mores of the era. And it was in this context that distant Dalgetty, near Bombala, but more remote still, emerged. Dalgetty's is a revealing tale. One man destined to play a highly significant, if now largely forgotten role, in the hunt for the capital, was long-time New South Wales politician Sir Joseph Carruthers. In 1927, when the Canberra Times brought out a special commemorative issue on the day of the opening of the Provisional Parliament in Canberra, the 9th of May, it was Sir Joseph Carruthers, a former New South Wales state politician and former New South Wales Premier, who was invited to recall the story of the federal capital birth. Typically forthright, Carruthers in a long article systematically recorded the details of what he called the Battle of the Sites and his leading role in it. Curiously, the article is neither a jubilant nor even a particularly satisfying recollection for the writer. Quite the contrary. At one point, in his opening paragraphs, he confesses, it is none too pleasant to revive these memories of other days, and if there has been any change for the better in these last 20 years, one could afford to close the veil. But they have continued from 1901 right down to 1927 and will only now cease when the Federal Parliament meets at Canberra and the real seat of government is inaugurated there. They have continued. They will not cease. Who is he talking about and what were their motives in meddling, in disrupting, in seemingly undermining? These questions need answering, but to do that, just a little bit more detail is needed. After the euphoria of the new nation celebrations in 1901, the Federation parliamentarians well knew that they had been entrusted by the nation with, as it was put at the time, expeditiously finding a permanent capital. So began the search, the extraordinary tours of the senators and members of the House of Representatives by train, by sea, by coach, and when necessary, even by foot. The first group to head out into the bush of New South Wales were the 3 weeks in February 1902. The reps, even more enterprising, went at breakneck pace over 2 weeks in May. Between them, they looked at sites in Armidale, Orange, Lyndhurst, Bathurst, Goulburn, Yass, Tumut, Bombala, Albury, Lake George and Canberra via the Queen Beyan railway station. At one point heading south, they jumped on a ferry at Nowra to hasten the trip to the potential capital city port town of Eden, Twofold Bay, where the town, typical of the time, erected a federal capital arch to welcome the visiting parliamentarians. These first tours were orchestrated by the former New South Wales Premier and former anti-federationist Sir William Lyon, after whom the Canberra suburb of Lynham was named, a big hulk of a man whom Billy Hughes, our controversial seventh Prime Minister, would describe as one of the most remarkable men in our history. Though New South Wales and federal politician Sir George Reid, our fourth Prime Minister, would sardonically refer to these 1902 tours as Lyon's picnics, we know that the astute Lyon had a political agenda. He always did. He was the member for the massive southern New South Wales electorate of Hume, which stretched all the way from Wagga to the Victorian border, and he desperately wanted the capital in his electorate. Lyon lobbied hard for Albury or Tumut, but his federal neighbour Austin Chapman, a robust federation personality who was also given his name to a Canberra suburb and who was the first member of the bellwether seat, and I see Malcolm in the audience, of Eden Monaro, Chapman with equal determination wanted the capital on his turf, So he promoted Bombala and the even more remote town of Dalgetty. Lyon and Chapman engaged in their own battle for the ultimate prize, and nearly 3 years of intense parlimentary debates later, on the 15th of August 1904, the first Labor federal government, led by the charismatic Chris Watson, saw through its only significant piece of legislation during a heavily contested 4 months in office. The seat of government would be Dalgetty. While historian Geoffrey Blaney, in his Shorter History of Australia, writes that freezing little Dalgetty was more suited for a penitentiary than a seat of government, what we can say with the benefit of 100 years of hindsight is that the town's plentiful water supply, inland location, and coal winters did give it contemporary appeal. The sheer abundance of water, so engaging to the eye in the surging waters of the Snowy River running right through the town, powerfully influenced two significant surveyors at the time, Sir John Forrest, and Charles Scrivener, a New South Wales district surveyor and the man who would eventually produce the Commonwealth Survey of the Canberra site in 1909 and later be appointed to the prestigious position of Director of Commonwealth Lands and Surveys. Forrest and Scrivener were adamant in 1904 that Dalgetty was the best site for the nation's capital, and their reputation and status could not easily be ignored, not even by the New South Wales politicians determined to see the capital much closer to Sydney. But against the considered research of Forrest and Scrivener was the first-hand testimony of the federal parliamentarians who experienced Dalgetty for themselves. Most found the site impossibly cold, as we would expect of any one of his descriptions of towns in rival Eden Monaro. William Lyon dismissed Dalgetty as an outlandish, freezing place, where the climate, he said, would kill half of the older men. Queensland House of Reps member Sinclair, used to balmy climbs, was utterly intimidated by the stunted timber and howling winds. Winds so severe, he declared, that you had to hang on for dear life. On one excursion to Dalgetty, a delegation of which Billy Hughes was a member, established the Order of the Blue-Legged Pelicans. A very weird society, Hughes would write, formed, in his words, at a place where the highest flights of nature's beauty are associated with her lowest temperatures. When the Federation founders were engaged on these regular visits a century ago, there were two hotels in Dalgetty, the Buckley's Crossing Hotel and Keating's Horse and Jockey Inn. A few wonderful stories of those stays have survived, and one, when the esteemed members of the Order of the Pelican were cosily ensconced in Keating's one typically brisk night, one of their number was almost the first fatality of the Federation tours, having suddenly found his trousers alight because he was too close to the fireplace. However, dousing the flame evidently proved more problematic than it might otherwise have been, for the reason that the member in question had a wooden leg. They managed to put him out safely. Most of our Federation-era forebears, Australian Britons to the core, revelled in winter weather. But it seems that with Dalgetty, they were prepared to draw a line in the snow. Sir Joseph Carruthers, in his 1927 Canberra Times reminiscence, called a meeting with a number of Tasmanian, recalled a meeting with a number of Tasmanian and Victorian members of the Federal Parliament, where he, Carruthers, mentioned Dalgetty's inaccessibility. Whereupon one of the members said, "Yes, that's exactly why I voted for Dalgetty." "What do you mean?" asked Carruthers. And the reply, "Don't you realise that quite a lot of us deliberately voted for the most impossible site in order to destroy the possibility of having a bush capital inflicted on Australia?" Now, in the last months of 1904, Carruthers, as Premier of New South Wales, knew nothing of these Victorian tactics. But he did know his constituency, and he did know the extent of his considerable power. The Australian Constitution stated that the capital had to be in New South Wales, but before any selected site could be operational, the New South Wales government had first to give the land to the Commonwealth. The New South Wales government had the whip hand. In effect, it had a right of veto. In a parliamentary speech, Carruthers, no doubt plain to his immediate and wider community audience in New South Wales, put it with crystal clarity. "Not one acre, not one foot, not one inch of our territory can be taken away or withdrawn from our governing powers without our consent and our authority." The ink of the Governor-General Lord Dudley's signature to the Dalgetty Seat of Government Act had hardly had time to dry on the page than Carruthers made clear to the Prime Minister of the day, George Reid, and his successor soon after, affable Alfred Deakin, that he was not happy. For Carruthers, like most of his New South Wales government colleagues, Dalgetty, on the same latitude as Nimitabill and Thredbo, was so close to the state of Victoria that it might as well be in that state. Besides, Dalgetty was just too bloody cold. The Dalgetty option disappeared. Now, it would reappear briefly and potently in the final discussions of 1908, but with the benefit of hindsight, we can say that the Dalgetty bid died on the parliamentary tables of Macquarie Street, late 1904. Distant Dalgetty's eclipse signalled the beginning of more accessible and amenable Canberra's rise. Case study 3, yes, Canberra. But why? Why the Canberra region rather than, say, appropriately frosty Armidale, nippy Orange, or even the more southerly and snowy hamlet of Tumut? In part, at least, this question has a grassroots explanation. It is a local story. It was the great fortune of the Canberra Queen Bee area in the 1880s, 90s and into the new century to have as its New South Wales parliamentary representative Edward William O'Sullivan. O'Sullivan was the member for Queen Bee for almost 20 years, from 1885 to 1904, during which time he played a productive role, first in helping to educate the area citizens about the benefits of a possible federation, much like Astley in Bathurst, and secondly, as one of the first colonial public figures to push the Canberra region's suitability as the national capital site. O'Sullivan was a great Australian and something of a Renaissance man in his broad cultural interests. One of our country's earliest republicans, he was also a supporter of the labour cause, an outspoken advocate of women's suffrage, a keen supporter of the arts, especially women in the arts, like Miles Franklin, for example. That's a whole other story. A playwright of popular plays such as the Eureka Stockade and Cooee. A novelist, a theatre lover, a sports lover, and above all, a serial founder of philanthropic organisations and promoter of worthy causes. The Bulletin, always eager to lop the heads off society's tall poppies, couldn't help but admire O'Sullivan's civic devotion. When O'Sullivan became the Minister for Public Works in the New South Wales State Government in the Federation year of 1901, he was, according to his biographer, the most dynamic force in his government, the New South Wales government at that time. The Queen Bee electorate admired him and learned much from him. He, in turn, recognised their political acumen, once memorably referring to his politically engaged constituents as the free selectors, farmers, and the intelligent democracy of Queanbeyan. The region was switched on, so much so that when William Lyon, as New South Wales Premier in 1899, asked the reputable President of the New South Wales Land Appeal Court, Alexander Oliver, to head up a royal commission to analyse the claims of the scattered Federal Capital Leagues, nearly two full years before Federation, it was no surprise that the Canberra-Queanbeyan democracy was ready to go, and none more so than the long-term local citizen, John Gale. A statue of Gale standing proudly on the corner of Low and Monero streets in Queanbeyan flamboyantly declares him to be the father of Canberra. Well, he wasn't, but undoubtedly he played a facilitating role, for it was Gale who first encouraged O'Sullivan to stand, and it was Gale who immediately followed up O'Sullivan's success in the 99 election with a plea to his observer readers to reject what he termed stultifying provincialism in favour of a higher platform of united Australian nationhood. This early, determined and sophisticated push by the citizens of Canberra-Queanbeyan to host the capital ensured that in the years after Federation, as the battle of the sites raged, the region would always be prominent in discussion. Carruthers and his government disqualified Dalgetty at the end of 1904. In the 18 months that followed, the New South Wales Premier went firmly on the front foot, committing his government to investigating quality alternative sites, and he would not brook Commonwealth interference with his task. When Prime Minister Deakin, in July 1905, ventured to taunt Carruthers with the resurrected corpse of Dalgetty, Carruthers sent an outraged reply, calling this gesture a breach of the Mother State's good faith and the honourable spirit of the Constitution Compact. Incredibly, In the conclusion to his letter to Deakin of August 1905, Carruthers could even resort to the barely veiled yet age-old threat of secession. Very big in the United States, of course. Until this question, he said, can be answered in the affirmative, there will be a grievance which will sorely strain the loyalty of this state to the Union. Carruthers ultimately got his way, sending the cream of his New South Wales Public Works Department in search of sites. And Greg Wood in the audience is the expert on this subject, of course. This bunch of highly capable individuals, men at the top of their respective design professions, soon interpreted the new policy as an encouragement to look south of Sydney, but not too far south. Pretty soon, everyone wanted to sneak a peek at the fine southern sites around Yass, Canberra and Lake George. The visits of the federal politicians to the region sharply increased. Queanbeyan's Federal Capital Site Committee, re-energised and refreshed, quickly got their orientation package together to accommodate this sudden and welcome demand. And moving, Harry, into concluding. Arguably, the turning point in the process was the winter months of July and August 1906, when Prime Minister Deakin, hitherto a Dalgetty man by default, finally began to take notice of the increasingly popular Canberra site. And more importantly, it was during this period that the future capital secured its most influential Labor's first Prime Minister, the debonair Chris Watson. Watson had every reason to stick like glue to Dalgetty, as I mentioned earlier. It was his government's only substantial piece of legislation. But once he came to Canberra and saw Canberra, he was overwhelmed. On the 15th of August 1906, Watson wrote to Carruthers, alerting the New South Wales Premier to Canberra, what he, Watson, now regarded as the best possible national capital site. Some 36 senators and MHRs accepted Carruthers' invitation to inspect a range of southern sites in mid-August, including Makulma, Lake George and Canberra. According to one participant on this visit, Canberra simply dazzled. Watson was delighted, quite certain that Canberra was the most beautiful site. In the forthcoming 2 years, a majority of his parliamentary colleagues would come to agree with him. Canberra's charge, fuelled and fostered by a politically literate Monero Plain citizenry, had begun in earnest, and it would prove successful. And to finally conclude, when Frederick Watson, in his important early volume, A Brief History of Canberra of 1927, commented in his preface on the Battle of the Sites, for he too used the phrase, he stated that he had, as he put it, omitted purposely the intimate history, as I think it would be unwise at present to publish the full details. End quote. The birth of Australia's capital city was no easy delivery, but while parochialism and provincialism could at times dominate, these motivations were countered and finally negated by a spirit of nation, a spirit embraced by many individuals who find themselves on the suburb and street signage in Canberra today. Such a tribute is the least we can do to recognise their crucial contributions to the national story. Thank you.
We have time for some questions, if we have any questioners. I could ask the questioners to go to the microphones so they can be recorded.
Quick question. Am I correct to say that the Australian Capital Territory was part of the division of Werriwa at the time of separation from New South Wales?
Can't answer that, Malcolm. That's a degree of detail that's just a little bit beyond me. I don't know whether there's any. And I'm looking, of course, at Greg and others. Greg,
it's just that you mentioned who the members for the other places were, but you didn't mention who the member for what became the Australian Capital Territory was.
No, I agree. And time just only permitted a certain amount. I was cutting as I was going, Malcolm. Greg, do you want to respond to that?
Thank you.
Right.
Now, if you don't know the answers, go to the experts in the audience. Okay, next.
I might ask him too. I wanted to ask about the Lake George site and exactly where around Lake George was the proposed site and was there any water in the lake at the time?
Gee, this, you know, Greg should be up here at the front here. First of all, I can answer the second part of that. There was no, you know, it's interesting through this period, and I think I did it, I know I did it in program number one on Stateline a few months ago, is that there's that splendid watercolour of Charles Coulter, which was on the cover of the Proceedings of the Congress of Engineers, Architects and Surveyors in Melbourne of 1901. And while you look at that and you see a Venice to all intents and purposes, in fact it was dry, and it was dry through this entire period. When we got rain, I'm not sure of, and Greg might know that, but it was certainly dry through the first decade post-Federation, so that you had that. In the case of the second response, it was because my sense is, and correct me on this if I'm wrong, Greg, and that is that down the Bungendore end of Lake George, and hence you had people like, say, John Gale, who was so prominent in Queanbeyan, also being on the Lake George Committee, that it was an area between, you know, basically coming back towards the what I guess would be the full extent of the lake, between Bungendore and the lake. Can you go any further with that, Greg? Do you know anything more? But it was precisely for that reason that it wasn't going to get going any further. I mean, this was too dramatic a prospect, so that was out. Penny?
That
was the end of the long drought of the late 1800s and the first decade of the 19th century, a worse drought than the one we're having now.
Where did the word Canberra really come from?
Oh, gee, there's a tough one.
Originate.
Since I was yesterday out at the National Capital Exhibition where one of the guides was saying that it came from Canberra, we know that there are, how does one respond to that question, three prospects. When you look at, say, Frederick Watson, who was mentioned in my paper, or some of the earlier non-Aboriginal writers about the area, the tendency in their works is to suggest that it came via Canberra. When you look at possibilities in terms of Aboriginal languages of the area, we know that there are two possibilities that emerge in the literature. One is Canberra as meeting place, and the other is Canberra as woman's breasts, looking at both Black Mountain and Mount Ainslie as the two breasts of the woman. In terms of the way we have settled in on meeting place, I suspect that is more because it fits the agendas of the moment than anything else. But, I'm interested that the white European writers tended to say that it came via Canberra, but we don't know the answer to that, because nothing that I've ever read is in any way convincing about the Aboriginal sources either. English town, does anyone in the audience, does anyone been to Canberra in England? All I can say is it's in England, but I don't know where. But it was brought out here was the name that was used in the earliest, from the earliest times. Can anyone help on that in this learned gathering? Someone up the back might be able to. Absolutely. Yeah, which was the name that was brought from England. But you pretty much finally take your pick. Yes. It was John Joshua Moore. Yeah. Yeah. Any other questions?
Right, we have a couple of questions over on the side.
I didn't probably appreciate until you gave the speech today, in many ways, what a remarkable event it was that Melbourne, having got the national capital and possession being 9/10 of the law, actually ended up not keeping it. With the deliberations, was there actually any clauses around timelines that they had to make a decision by a certain period of time, or could it have just gone on forever?
And the answer is it could have just gone on forever, and of course, as I said in my talk, that's what they were hoping for. It's interesting that, I suppose, as the epilogue to this story, that there were two or three mentions in The Age in the early 1950s about getting the capital back. Forget giving it up, but actually saying that Canberra was so run down circa 1951, 52, 53 that it should revert to Melbourne. But no, written into the constitution was that they would be the temporary site until there was a permanent site, and of course, exactly as you said, they were hoping the possession was 9/10 of the law.
Now, other question over on the side.
What about Yass in the description Yass Canberra? Mm. I assume that was just a ruse to delude the Victorian members into thinking it wasn't too far away and on the mainline railway.
That's exactly right, and it was a package. It seems that both Chris Watson and George Reed, ever the tactician who finally had decided that the capital wasn't going to be just west of Sydney where he originally wanted, he, George Reed, so he moved to ultimately support, and I suspect that support was, if not crucial, then extremely important at the last, because he really was, as we know, a particularly significant strategist, that Reed and Watson swung round to it, and that was important. But we're going to think of the way in which it should get packaged as an option. Calling it Yass Canberra was, of course, had railway implications, and also had a sense that, and you can almost see it now, that idea that this was an area and that we would get that through and then you would hone in on the site itself. So once it became known as Yass Canberra, it was immediately garnering more support, and ultimately, of course, it would get the support, albeit, as I said at the beginning of the paper, in a very close-run race in the last months of 1908.
A question over on the side.
To argue that this history continues to have some sort of subconscious influence on perceptions of Canberra, or does it just go with the territory by being a national capital that it's perceived the way it is?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I suppose with a reasonable amount of the reading that I've done in recent years about Canberra's history, especially from the 1950s, it appears that, and John Overall's talked about this in his book, it appears that the high point of the disparagement of Canberra in the 20th century was the back end of the 1930s, 40s and early 50s, when phrases such as Canberra is the cemetery with lights, or the ruin of a good sheep station, or seven suburbs in search of a city, or the best way to see Canberra was the back of a departing train, etc. That was the high point of this disparagement. When Menzies, who himself, to use the word that he used, hated Canberra, ultimately became, again to use his word, an apostle for Canberra, that's in the middle to later 50s and beyond. So the high point of the disparagement was the 40s, kind of early 50s. But that disparagement, as we know, has continued. I suspect, no more than anecdotally, and the kinds of reports that are decreasingly obvious in other papers around the country, that sort of easy, cheap shot stuff is very much on the decline. But it will always be with us in some form or other, for the very reason, to pick up the second part of your question, that we are the national capital. So that it's so easy for commentators to use the term, that generic term, Canberra, when they in fact mean the politicians. But as we know, even in the election coming up, that even some of the candidates have raised this issue and their annoyance at it, but that's going to be with us forever, and that's the lot of being a national capital.
Yeah, well, last question over here.
I've sort of got a question and a comment, if that's okay. First of all, a comment. One of my favourite books is Bill Bryson's Down Under, which is a wonderful book and very informative, but I don't think I've read a book that bags Canberra so badly. I think it describes it as a city hidden in a bush, and the author never finds it and gets drunk on his own and leaves in disgust. If you're involved with the celebration of Canberra, I know Bill Bryson comes back every year for the Writers' Festival, and maybe you could engage him and show him the better side and get this terrible entry in his book fixed up, because I love to recommend that book, but I've got great reservations because of his experience. The other question I had was, I was told that the national capital was not allowed, the guidelines were, it wasn't allowed to be on the coastline, and that Department of Defence had put that in because they didn't want to have the national capital subject to a naval bombardment. Is that correct?
Certainly one of the reasons, and I did mention it ever so briefly in my paper today, that that notion of being inland was for precisely that reason. Going inland was, A, to escape bombardment, and B, the sense that many had that if you're at sea level, then disease was far more likely to afflict the city. So they went inland for those two reasons. In the case of Bill Bryson, God knows I, and I'm sure many people in this audience would welcome any kind of engagement there. I only respond by saying that what are we in a population of just on 330,000 now, and I know that we're hearing and have in the last 2 or 3 weeks the suggestion that we will be aiming at sort of 500,000 not too far down the track. Well, as someone who feels so passionately about this city, I'd like to see it slowly going up from 330,000 pretty much until I die and become a part of the soil of the place, because it's one of the delights of the town. And don't even start me, I was very much involved a few years ago in the study known as the Griffin Legacy, and one of the most enjoyable parts of that was actually reading into the history of City Beautiful and Garden City ideas, which got an ever so brief mention in today's paper, that came forward. One of the, in fact, I probably should put in a plug for it, the ACT government, through the Centenary of Canberra unit, has commissioned 6 booklets which will come out in either March or April of next year. Greg's doing 2 of them, Greg Wood, I'm doing 2, Ian Warden is doing 1, and Stuart McKenzie, who did the Griffin Legacy with me, is doing another. And what those booklets are basically doing is diving a little more, sort of digging a little bit more deeply into the deep background history of this city, given that Roger Pegram's book, of course, goes through the search for the site story, you know, very, very well indeed. But we're going back as much as anything to look at the whole set of visionary ideas amongst Western nations, largely, that found their way into the discussions, the parliamentary discussions primarily, colonial parliaments rather, of the 1880s and especially the 1890s, where the vision stuff was emerging, so that people like Henry George, and we know that in terms of Canberra being leasehold, the influence, Edward Bellamy's utopian novel called Looking Backwards, along with writers like Walt Whitman, Thoreau, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and then you could, I mean, that whole brigade of visionary thinkers who were literally cited in the discussions, the parliamentary discussions of the 1890s and beyond, so that the bar was always going to be a very high visionary bar for the city. And I say all of that because it's a part of the story of Canberra that people like Bill Bryson and many others, including many other Australians, have no clue about. So this idea of Canberra based on a wonderful set of ideas, which doesn't mean they all got implemented, but based on a wonderful set of ideas, is one of the genuinely hidden narratives which will bubble to the surface in the centenary years between now and 2013. So watch this space and perhaps keep your eye out for those booklets.
Right, well, we'll get you back at an appropriate time. Please join me in thanking our lecturer.
Thank you.